Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Well, hello, listeners. This is going to be a great conversation today, and I'm really excited because I've been waiting a couple of months to get this wonderful doctor in with me today. I have Dr. Breanne Betcher, who is the assistant professor and director of neuropsychology research at the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you back.
Yes.
I had you on about a year ago, and the listeners really liked what we talked about. And it was fun because I think we had added a little piece to our conversation last year about more young women being in science and wanting to be part of this. And it just may not be sort of the sexiest part of being a doctor or being a researcher, what have you, but we need people like you to join in the charge. So thanks for being here, Bree.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Well, you have been doing some amazing things lately.
We have a lot of exciting things going on. I think there's been a lot of updates since I saw you last year.
Right. Yeah. And we're going to delve into them today, aren't we? So what have you been working on lately? I know you're building a healthy aging program. Tell my listeners what that is about.
Yeah, so I think last time we talked a lot about other aspects of my work, so working with individuals with Alzheimer's disease and other what we call neurodegenerative syndromes. We also are really focusing a lot on healthy aging and building a program where we're answering questions like, what is normal aging? How do we predict who is at risk for decline later in life? And how do we learn from people who are doing really well? I think the Alzheimer's disease research world is really moving towards a focus on better understanding what healthy aging looks like, and particularly trying to determine the early stages of Alzheimer's disease before symptoms are even starting.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult to do.
Yes.
I mean, even with a discerning eye, to capture any symptoms, mild or not, mm-hmm. That seem random even, could turn into something bigger at another point in time. And so looking at that must be a little bit difficult.
It is. It's challenging. I think one thing that we really know about aging, healthy aging, typical aging, is that it's very heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. So some people, as they get older, don't have any symptoms of memory problems or thinking difficulties. Some go on to develop Alzheimer's disease, and trying to tease apart and disentangle subtle changes that are occurring before you really start manifesting symptoms is tough. And it's something that I think is really critical if we're going to determine how to detect Alzheimer's disease early, treat it early. We're going to have to really understand what changes are occurring in healthy aging.
Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, what would your next step be? I mean, how, if you can actually figure that out and you can try to look at the early moments, then what would you do when you have that information? How would you make a difference with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the long-term goal of that is, you know, A, to figure out who has it before there are symptoms. So if you have that information, you could help channel people to clinical trials earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There are, in fact, some clinical trials that are doing that right now, where they're looking at healthy people and trying to treat before symptoms start.
Mm-hmm.
I think also finding the exact target for treatment is going to be critical. And I think that's something that a lot of people aren't aware of, that so many of the treatments have understandably focused on individuals who have later stages of Alzheimer's
right.
disease.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned is that the earliest stages may tell us something quite different about what treatments are needed than
mm-hmm.
the later stages.
Right.
It's dynamically changing over time. So a treatment that might help at the ends later stages might not be the one early before you're starting to show symptoms. So I think
right.
to answer your question, how we would use that information is to identify, bring people into clinical trials earlier, and try to find a better target for treatment.
Okay. So if I'm following this well enough, how would you know? Are you looking for somebody that maybe has this in their family? Would that be more helpful to you if they're okay today? And you're trying to see, because if you're just taking people randomly, how would you discern between people who may never get it, you know, so you're not having sort of a flat clinical trial or what have you. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So do you need people that have this in their family? Would that be more helpful to your studies?
I think that definitely can be helpful in terms of having greater risk factors. Mm-hmm. But I think in general, what we really want is to understand aging at more of a population level. We know age is the greatest risk factor for
right.
Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
And so when we bring people in who are 60 and over and are studying them, we're learning from them. And we're looking at things like, are there changes in Alzheimer's proteins in their blood or in their spinal fluid? We're looking at immune changes. And so I think bringing people in who have risk factors is important, but also understanding people who don't have those risk factors, because some of those individuals also develop Alzheimer's disease.
Right. Mm-hmm. And with the numbers going up and up and up and up,
mm-hmm.
you know, what is it, 1 in 3 over the age
mm-hmm.
of 80?
Mm-hmm.
And it's even close, but not quite as dramatic as that, 1 in 6 or 7 for people around the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when we're not using our retention, people today are using the easy street all the time, trying to have Siri and Alexa turn on lights and all those kinds of things.
That's true.
I'm afraid that technology is going to bring us more people. In its inception, it was supposed to be really good, but I think we're putting ourselves in a danger of not doing things for ourselves anymore and not troubleshooting, thinking through processes, not using our retention. I feel like that could be a problem at some point. Do you think so, too?
It's an interesting point. It's not been well researched.
I know.
On the other end of it exactly what you're saying, that people who are really engaged, who are involved in cognitively stimulating activities, so whether it's going to lectures or reading, people who are physically active, all these individuals seem to have reduced risk.
Right.
And so if you kind of follow that logic along, you would think that there could be
right.
concerns there about not doing things for yourself as much when you're younger.
Right. Well, some of the things I wanted to talk to you about today is you've given me some great information. What exactly do you mean when you say you're determining what individual factors offer protection against decline? What makes us resilient to decline?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so we know that people who have Alzheimer's disease, that their changes in the brain started 10, 15 plus years prior to them showing symptoms. So we know that, you know, if you take a group of individuals in their 70s, that maybe about 20% of those will have some abnormal changes in Alzheimer's disease proteins, but are not showing any symptoms at all. And so we want to try to figure out, are there factors that help protect people early on? And by factors, I mean looking at things in your immune system, looking at things in your blood that might be helpful to protect or stave off decline. We're also trying to look at risk. And so are there things that we can measure
mm-hmm.
That also seem to confer risk for a later decline? And again, that, you know, given that it's 10 to 15 years prior to showing symptoms that you're having changes, it seems to be a really critical period of time in your 60s and 70s to understand what puts you on a different trajectory.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about why it's important to understand normal aging and early Alzheimer's. Just from a personal experience, I can tell you that I've been working with my sister, who was showing some mild cognitive impairment signs several years ago. And I thought over the last 2 years that she really was moving into a different place, a different level. And I have chosen, I think I'm excited to talk to you about this. I have chosen to talk to her and be very open with her from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually doing something close to a case study, trying to watch my sister, who even the people that are doing our longitudinal study at WashU didn't see the signs that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't live with her. She lives in another state.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see some things going on. So talking to her and trying to discern what's normal aging and what is different. And things I noticed were that she was unable to learn new things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was becoming a struggle. And
mm-hmm.
it was daily intervention to help her with something that was new or foreign to her, which I think is one of the keys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about what you just said.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, I think one thing that you mentioned that is really important to point out is when we are working with people, we are basing a lot of our information on what's happening at a group level, right? So we study lots and lots of people. We take those group averages, group findings, and are applying them to individuals. But in reality, everybody is different. The heterogeneity we see is also on an individual level. And so what you described as being able to see something before the researchers did is important. What I tell families a lot of times is you are the expert on this person as well as the patient is an expert on themselves as well. And so there can be changes that are very significant that we're not fully detecting yet. And it could be that you were superior in some sort of area and now you're average to high average. And if I looked at that, I wouldn't know as a
right.
researcher. So it's so, so helpful for us to hear from families, to study groups of people and hear those things from you, that this is a change. It's really helped shift our understanding.
I agree. Go ahead.
And you know, just to also follow up on what you were saying, you know, kind of in pushing to do new things. Again, we often call that kind of cognitively stimulating
mm-hmm.
activities. I agree. I think those are very important. And it's not to say that you should be doing things that are stressful. We don't encourage that. But things that really keep your brain active, we think is very helpful.
Right. And for my sister, it was training a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So we put a lot of effort into that. But other things that I noticed, trouble balancing her checkbook, things that upon asking her would be revealed, such as she let me know recently that she doesn't read as much as she used to and she likes to, but she has trouble following the page.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the communication skills that I often use with folks are to take a piece of paper that is blank or you just fold it in half and go straight down each line by line by line by line of a paragraph
mm-hmm.
so that you can clearly see it
mm-hmm.
and have that help you or guide you with that. But those were those subtle changes that you wouldn't see.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I thought was important, and I'd like to know if this could be important if we can get some folks in your new studies we're going to talk about. I really wanted to make sure that I was talking to my sister about any piece of any narrative that we had about whether it was her reading or if it was her balancing her checkbook or anything like that, and just being really open and telling her that I was documenting it and sending it to WashU
mm-hmm.
so that they would have a better understanding
mm-hmm.
when she is in their research trial.
That's wonderful, yes.
Yeah. So.
I think a lot of folks often are curious why we ask so many different questions in
right?
research. We cover things that I think a lot of people wonder why would you need to know that? How is that possibly related to Alzheimer's disease? And it's because of these very things that you're talking about. We don't have all the answers yet. And so trying to see what subtle changes, whether it's lifestyle things, whether it's reading, we ask all sorts of questions about, you know, what are your activities? How have they changed? Do you read a lot? Do you go out and do outdoor activities? What's your physical exercise like?
Mm-hmm.
Have you had recent infections? Have you been sick? You
know, right.
All these different things that we ask lots of questions about to learn from from you guys.
Mm-hmm. It makes a difference. And you had said something about with the early aging, normal aging and the early Alzheimer's, how those pieces become dysregulated. Is that what you mean, where we're missing those pieces, where we're seeing skewed behavior or something different in the cognitive levels? Is that what you meant by that? Can you explain by that?
In terms of what's becoming dysregulated?
Right.
You know, I think in Alzheimer's disease, we've really focused a lot on two proteins, which are amyloid and tau, and how those become dysregulated. We've learned that that's not the whole picture. And I think there's been a shift in focus to what else is going on that can cause atypical features or even typical features, and that can be changes in your immune system, that can be changes in important growth factors that could be protective. There are all aspects of those. I'm particularly focused on the immune system. It's a really hot topic right now in the, in the field.
Yeah. And so since you mentioned it, we're going to talk about an actual study that you're working on right now. But before we go into that, I want to talk about what you just said about the beta amyloid and the tau.
Mm-hmm.
I think in general, people since 1904, with Dr. Alois Alzheimer's and Augusta Dieter, have been looking at the beta amyloid. You actually came to us from San Francisco. You came to Denver from San Francisco, where you were focusing very much on the tau. And Dr. Holtzman at WashU, where our study, our familial study is, he also focuses on the tau. Can you explain that? I think people kind of think they understand beta amyloid, but and the plaques and tangles, but hardly anybody knows about the tau. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so the like I said, the two main proteins that are abnormal in Alzheimer's disease, we know are amyloid and tau. We think there are other things as well, but those have been the ones we focused on the most. Amyloid plaques, we believe, start to accumulate many, many years prior to symptoms. Tau seems to occur a little bit later in the course. How I tend to think about it is that it's more closely linked with the symptoms that you're having. Whereas amyloid, if you look at it and compare it to symptoms, it's definitely a marker. It kind of says, we think part of the Alzheimer's disease process is on board, it's occurring. Whereas tau seems to be temporally, so linked in time to your symptoms. And so as you start to develop tau in the brain, it accumulates in areas that are really important for things like memory. You get a much more widespread, unfortunately, pattern with amyloid, but tau seems to be very, very closely linked with the symptoms that you're having.
Interesting.
So it'll accumulate in the part of the brain like the hippocampus, which is really important for memory. And so people have become much more interested in it because it seems to be, again, closer to that point where you might be developing symptoms. It's also related to other diseases that can happen that I know that you're interested in as well, and many of the listeners. But I think overall the Alzheimer's field has really started to shift a focus on tau as a target. We now can do some imaging methods with it. We can measure it in the spinal fluid. And again, really linked to symptoms and severity, much more so than amyloid.
That's really important to me because my mom started showing signs at 58. Through 23 years, she presented Alzheimer's symptoms. Clinical Alzheimer's symptoms. But because we're in a study, a longitudinal study, WashU received my mom's brain. It actually went to Columbia first and then came back. They gave me the results. She did not have a single beta amyloid plaque or tangle in her brain, not one.
Wow.
Her brain was totally destroyed by the tau.
Wow.
And she had a C9orf72 mutation. So that's always just blown me away. That's why I'm interested, and that's why we're talking about the tau today, because it shows a lot of the same symptoms, and that's just what you were saying. It may be what causes the symptoms. And some folks may never have it. Some, like my mom, her brain was completely destroyed by it, plus four in every area. So that's a way that you acknowledge the damage to a brain, is the plus numbers, I'm understanding?
Part of it, yes. Yeah. It's not the whole picture, but yeah. I think where it is in the brain mm-hmm. is really, really important. So if it's mm-hmm. in the part of the brain that affects memory, you'll have memory symptoms. If
right.
it's in the part of the brain that affects something else, the symptoms will look different.
Right. So her official cause of death was hippocampal sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
That absolutely blew my mind. Well, we're going to take a short break and thank our sponsors for always supporting this show and letting me bring great resources and information to you. But when we come back, you have a new R01 study, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk about that. It's funded by the National Institute on Aging, and I can't wait for you to tell the listeners about it. So
great.
Everybody, you might want to get a pad and pencil and write some notes on this. We'll be right back. Hey friends, I'm excited to tell you about Pine Grove Crossing Assisted Living and Memory Care in Parker, Colorado. They set the bar high for person-centered care. They're locally owned and they focus on exceeding their residents' expectations while providing excellent dining, housekeeping, and transportation services. Their care team with licensed nurses are available 16 hours per day, 7 days a week, to ensure clinical needs are addressed as soon as possible. Check them out at pinegrovecrossing.com or 303-996-8000 and see how care goes into everything they do.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, we're back, and I have Dr. Breanne Betcher with me, and she is from the University of Colorado Medical School here at the Anschutz campus, but she really works with a lot of great programs right now, trying to see ahead, try to stay ahead of Alzheimer's disease, and you have a new study.
Yes, I do. We are very fortunate that we were able to obtain a grant from the National Institute on Aging. It's called an R01 grant. And the goal of this is really to understand how immune function changes over time in healthy aging, and in particular, how immune changes in the body and immune changes in the brain might be related to memory decline over time.
Okay.
So we are recruiting for that study, and that we'll be looking again at healthy older adults, so adults 60 and over who aren't having memory symptoms, haven't been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or another neurological problem. And they'll come in for an initial visit and then 2 years later, and we'll be tracking all these different aspects of immune function and health, looking at your brain, looking at Alzheimer's markers, all of that, and tracking over time.
Okay. We've said it a couple of times. I think maybe we better explain. What do you mean by immune?
Yes. I think this is something that's a huge, huge change in the Alzheimer's field. It's been a big focus. We were just at the International Alzheimer's Conference. It's a really big target, I think, for thinking about Alzheimer's disease and how to treat it. So we know that as we get older, that there are changes in your immune system with everyone in general. Mm-hmm. Your immune system should be something that's really good for you, right?
Right.
We all need it. We would not be alive without it.
Right.
It fights diseases, all sorts of pathologies. But as we get older, it changes. And you start to mount an immune response when you don't necessarily need to. And you develop systemic inflammation throughout the brain and the body.
That doesn't sound good.
With healthy aging in particular, we see systemic, meaning in the body, changes in inflammatory markers. So mm-hmm. inflammatory markers are higher in your 60s and generally in your 20s. And so we know these changes are happening. It really wasn't until the last 10 years, though, that we realized that the immune system is playing a pretty critical role in early Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. Okay.
It's a little unclear as to whether it's good at specific stages versus bad across the board. So if you mount and sustain an immune response for too long, it can actually start to damage brain cells, so you're the neurons in the brain.
Okay.
So we're trying to better understand that. We're trying to understand, Are there aspects of immune changes that could be positive, that could be helpful, that we could harness and really use as a target for a mm-hmm. therapy? And are there aspects of it that we think are bad for the brain and for Alzheimer's disease that we would want to dampen down? We know it's dynamically changing over time. We know it's very, very closely linked with the beginning stages of Alzheimer's disease proteins, but we don't know yet how it works.
Okay. Wow. So you've got a multifaceted approach, or I don't want to say problem, but that's a lot. Mm-hmm. So you have to figure that out first, mm-hmm. and then once you do, you have to figure out the answer for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
That's the important piece of these observational studies mm-hmm. where we bring people in and learn from you.
Right.
Really better understanding what does the immune system look like in normal aging and is it associated with Alzheimer's disease later in life?
Mm-hmm. So there's so much that you have to uncover there. Why exactly does blood and spinal fluid matter? Why are you looking mm-hmm. at that? I think my listeners would like to know that.
Absolutely. So we can understand some aspects of what changes in your body and your brain by asking you questions, right? Mm-hmm. We can ask you about your health history, if you have autoimmune conditions, if you've had inflammatory conditions. But to really get a sense of what's going on, we have to be able to measure it. And these immune markers can be measured in the blood. And so when they're measured in the blood, we think that they're telling us something about what's happening in your body. To really get a sense of what's going on in the brain, we have to measure it in the spinal fluid. So the spinal fluid is something that your brain sits in. It protects it. But the brain also releases some of these immune markers as well as Alzheimer's proteins into the spinal fluid. And so by looking at both, it gives us a more complete picture of what's happening to your immune system over time as we age.
I think that's exciting because I think over the 115 years since it was originally discovered, and even Dr. Louis worked in the same lab as Dr. Alzheimer's did, mm-hmm. right? And these diseases have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the most encouraging information that I've heard about different ways that you're now trying to look at this and attack it and understand it on a different level and really approach it at a different level mm-hmm. because we really just know that there's such limited efficacy to the pharmas that have come out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the answer.
Right.
It's not the answer. We've got to figure out something else. So we were at a event mm-hmm. recently, and someone asked you about getting a blood test.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how you answered that person. So I get that question a lot, and because I'm non-medical, I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, you
mm-hmm.
know. But let's talk about that. Since we're talking about blood and spinal fluid, what can you find out from somebody's blood? And you don't just want to go in and take a blood test. I don't even know if you can, and find out if you have the pathology for Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I think what ultimately we would like is to have a blood test, and I think we're moving closer to that.
Right.
But currently there are a lot of barriers to that. So there is a blood-brain barrier. And because of that blood-brain barrier, which is really important for keeping us healthy, it's not as easy to have a good understanding of what's going on in the brain by looking at the blood. I think we're hopeful. Like I said, we're moving, you know, inching towards that. And there's some exciting news, I think, on the forefront of being able to measure things like tau in the blood. But it's not currently available for, I think, a reason right now, which is it's not an exact window into the brain. There mm-hmm. are many barriers between your blood and the brain, which means that the proteins that we're measuring are not a mirror image of it. And so when we talk about things like spinal fluid, which I know can be a very scary topic for people, the reason that we think that's so important and such an important gift to research is that it does provide a window into the brain. It's still a proxy, but it's more of a window into what is being released by the brain.
Okay. So, and it just could possibly be inaccurate as well. So
correct.
Somebody could even have the APOE for gene and have it be dormant, right? So you could.
I think the other question, that you're alluding to there is that folks often want to get a blood test for a genetic marker of Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
And ApoE, or apolipoprotein E, is one of the most common genetic risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. We all have this gene, but we have different forms of it. You can get a blood test that tells you the form of it that you have. The reason that we often don't recommend that clinically is that you can have a risk form of it. It's called the E4 allele. And yes, absolutely will puts you more at risk for Alzheimer's disease. But there are people who have that who never develop it. And then in turn, there are people who don't have that risk form and do develop it.
Yeah.
And I think people don't realize that just getting that test does not tell you on an individual level if you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease later.
Right.
Or not.
So, as we circle back to the new study that you're working on, why it's so important for people to be a part of a study of some sort. You can use trialmatch.com. Go on and see what you might be willing to do in terms of time, in terms of your body, in terms of what they need. It's not that hard, folks. I have to tell you, my family has been involved in a study for many, many years. It's a longitudinal study. I love being part of it. I do. I love being part of it. And it's fascinating. It's not great when you have a new family member starting down that path. But it has been a real eye-opener to me to feel like I'm doing something.
Mm-hmm.
We're part of trying to find a cure. We can sit on the sidelines and we can complain.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, a class I was giving, somebody said, I'd like to give my brain to science. Well, you know what? That's a lovely idea. But the truth is, they don't want your brain when you die if they haven't had a chance to know you while you were alive. People, come on. Yeah, seriously, you have to think about this. They want to know about your life. I hear this constantly, people saying, I want to give my brain to science. Well, you have to do the work prior. It's like having a football game with no players and expecting a score at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work, right?
Right?
I just made that up. But it's kind of like that. You really need to study that person,
mm-hmm.
and understand who they are so you can have a baseline,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
to judge it from. And I think I told you that with the study I'm in WashU, every year they have us come and we answer a bunch of questions and we have to recite paragraphs that they've given us that are ridiculously long, full of a lot of information. And also they will give us numbers that we have to repeat the way they were given. Then we have to say them backwards. We have to put them in chronological order, in numeric order, things like that. And I'm not going to lie. It's exhausting. By the time I'm done, I'm like, wow, I wonder how I did this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a common
thought.
But the truth is, that's what is helpful to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's your baseline.
Absolutely.
So you're not even asking that much in the new trial you're doing. So walk somebody through what it would look like from the minute they sign the papers and come in.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought all that up. We are, we're so passionate about the work that we do. And I hope people know, too, that we really want to partner with our community to solve this awful problem of Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
And really to do that, we have to learn from the community of aging folks. That's the way that we're going to disentangle this. And so we have a lot of different studies going on. The one that I mentioned before, if you come in and you meet the criteria for it, that we usually have 2 days in the beginning where someone comes in and we ask you a bunch of questions about your health history. We ask you about the activities that you do in your day-to-day life, your physical activities, your leisure activities. We do all sorts of memory and thinking tests, which I know can be exhausting, but are really helpful to us. We get a brain MRI, so a picture of what your brain looks like.
Okay.
We,
and wait a minute. So you're looking for the density of the brain, how big it is in circumference, or what are you looking for when,
yeah,
with an MRI? So, people don't understand what an MRI will tell you.
Yeah, so an MRI, it lets us get a visual image of the brain at a very high detail level. And so we can look at volumes of specific parts of the brain. So I can look at the part of the brain that's really important for memory and see if there are any changes in that over time.
Oh.
I can relate it to other things, like is that size of the part of your brain called your hippocampus related to these immune markers in your blood?
Okay.
We can also look at a collection of different areas that we know are vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease and look at volumes of those as well.
Okay. Awesome.
So there's a lot of information you can get from that.
Yeah. I'd just like to break that down because I think a lot of people just go in and get an MRI and they don't really understand what it tells you. It's actually telling you a lot. So what else? Now they've had their MRI.
Yes. So we get a blood draw and we store that so we can look at different markers in the blood. And then we also get a spinal tap, so getting the spinal fluid as well. We often talk to someone close to that person as well with their permission to just see how they feel like the person's doing as well. And then they'll come back in 2 years later and do the exact same thing. So we'll get a longitudinal piece to it.
And so you're looking for, let's be specific here, 180 healthy older adults, age 60 and over to come in for the initial evaluation and subsequent evaluation 2 years later, like you were just explaining. And I love how you really lay this out. You're just tracking the immune health history factors such as infection, surgical procedures, autoimmune conditions, so on and so forth. And you have to meet those goals or you're going to lose your ROI grant, right? You need those people to come.
It's definitely
people
very
come.
We are definitely very appreciative of anybody who, you know, shows interest and wants to be in our studies. There's a wide variety of different things to participate in, but we definitely appreciate anyone who shows an interest and is willing to participate in those.
Well, I'm glad because you have said to me that if you meet your recruitment goals, you'll be able to see some results in 3 to 4 years,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That could tell you a lot. So I want to tell the listeners about how to sign up for this. Okay. So Bree already explained that it's 2 research visits over the course of 2 years. The procedures include, and I think you just mentioned mm-hmm. them. Do you want to go ahead and say them again one more time?
Sure. So we do some tests of your memory and your thinking. We get all sorts of questionnaires about your health history and your daily activities. We get a blood sample, a spinal fluid sample, and an MRI of the brain.
Okay.
For folks that want to learn just more about our healthy aging studies, you're welcome to go to our website, which is coloradoagingbrain.org.
Okay.
If you are interested in participating in research studies, you can call our recruitment line, which is 303-724-4644. And just mention that you're interested in healthy aging studies.
Okay.
That's the same number that you would call to if you are interested in Alzheimer's disease studies where you or a loved one has Alzheimer's disease and wants to participate.
Okay. So. Well, I have thousands of listeners in the Denver metropolitan area and throughout Colorado. People, really, it's an easy program. I joked about the fact that it's exhausting, but you know what? At the end of the day, when I've gone for my neurobehavioral exams and I have to ask a zillion questions and things mm-hmm. like that, I feel so good. You know, I really do. And I go with my sisters and my brother. We all go as a unit. You could go with your friends. You could do this as a group. And it helps. And then afterwards, go out for dinner or something. You know, it's just – and then just know that you're a part of trying to solve a puzzle that has eluded us for 115 years. We've got to find a cure. The numbers are going up and up and up. Right now, we're at 5.4 million people just in the United States, 14 million worldwide. But that number in 2025, in just 5 years, they think in the United States is going to go up to 14 million.
Mm-hmm.
If
it's
that
staggering.
Yes, that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will.
Yeah.
Honestly, that is a very, very scary thought. So again, that number is 303 724-4644. You can also, email at neurologyresearchpartners@ucdenver.edu to learn more. And this is an easy program, folks. You sign up. You have to be over 60. You need to just be in good shape and not have, well, not necessarily in good shape. You just have to not have any symptoms of Alzheimer's at this point in time. If you have any questions, you can find this information on my website, summitresiliencetraining.com. I will have the flyer posted. I already have it posted. You can go on and look right now. I think this is important stuff, Bree.
Thank you. This is
really big. This is good.
We're really grateful to have the opportunity to do this kind of study and learn from our aging community and partner with you all to try to figure this out.
Yeah, it's just amazing. We're going to take a break and listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Okay, I'm back with Bree Betcher from the University of Colorado Hospital. And I love your title. I'm just going to say this again. Assistant Professor, Director of Neuropsychology Research.
Rolls off the tongue, right?
It does, right? So I think what you're doing is very, very positive in a world that can be very, very negative.
Mm-hmm.
Losing a loved one to memory loss, to cognitive impairment is painful. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. But the work you're doing is phenomenal. So how do you see that?
Yeah, thank you. I think a motto amongst our group and our lab members is that we learn just as much from people who are doing very well, who are not having memory symptoms, as those who are. And we feel really strongly that, in order to fight this disease, to find a cure for this disease, we also have to understand the positive aspects of aging. And there are many protective factors out there as well. And I think that we have long ignored some of those, that there are just tremendous things that help people stave off decline. And I think that will be also a critical part of this, is really thinking about aging from multiple different lenses and helping people understand that it's that there are positive things, too, that we really want to capitalize on.
So what are some of those things? I mean, I can wager a guess, exercise, eating right, but what's your view?
Yeah, so I think those are things that absolutely, we know that physical exercise, particularly in, they're finding more and more that midlife, it's incredibly important. So in your 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. but that it's never too late. That's been an incredible finding as
well.
It's never too late to start getting involved in exercise and really enjoy the benefits of that. And so those kind of protective factors, I think, are really exciting. I think there's also factors in terms of how socially active someone is. So getting a sense of what people do in their spare time is also something that we are really interested in as a protective factor.
Mm-hmm.
There's also factors there that we're just learning about that you can also measure in blood and in spinal fluid that are growth factors that seem to have a positive impact on aging trajectories that might help explain why some people have changes in the brain and not show any symptoms at all. And okay. So we're trying to better characterize and understand those as well.
Okay. So I want to go back to the first one you spoke about, which is exercise. So you're fairly young. I would guess you're 20 years younger than I am, at least. And that's okay. It's all good. But when I was young, I played music. You know, I was always using moving band equipment and PA systems and all that kind of stuff and was super, super active. And even, I swear it was good cardio just singing in a club, you know, mm-hmm. playing rock music was really good. I think so anyway. And then I also, I rock climbed, technical mm-hmm. rock climbed. I belonged to an international group called She Climbs. Okay. And I did that for many, many years. As we get older, I used to joke that any fall that I took on a sheer face that was 3,000 feet high, I would remember happily if something ached. Not the case. not helpful to me. That's not how that goes at all. I just go, oh, man, my hip hurts today. Yeah. But over time, I found that to be more difficult as I get older. I'm pushing 60 now, and that's okay. My husband and I still play music. I'm still moving PAs and stuff like that. I walk my dog. I play with my dog, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. I love that. I'm an active person. I'm really busy. And when I'm in teaching a class, I try to walk back and forth. I tell you, if I could get my steps, I have thousands of steps in a four-hour class, you know, that kind of thing. But as we get older, it's a little harder to engage in those things. So those things become challenging. Mm-hmm. And I want to challenge my listeners to find something out there that you can do for exercise. Is it just doing lunges on a chair in your dining room? Do gardening. Do some things just that you can really get your mm-hmm. exercise up. The second thing you spoke about was socially. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes a lot of the families I work with have lost fun. They've forgotten what fun is. I hear this constantly when I'm doing in-home assessments. They get sort of depressed and let their life sort of slip away. I encourage you to go to a senior center or something like that to play cards or do some crafts or do some artwork or something like that. Please, people, don't lose your purpose. Don't lose your hope. Really try to find a new purpose. As we grow older, we have to look at things a little differently, mm-hmm. you know? Go out with friends to lunch or have friends over for breakfast or something like that. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think those are great points. I think it's important not to lose sight of the fact that what you're doing now doesn't have to look exactly like it did in your 20s or 30s, right?
Yes.
And so finding things that, you know, the disclaimer of check with your physician and make sure there's nothing concerning that would argue against this, but finding things that get your heart rate up, and that can look different for an individual, right? It doesn't have to be something incredibly strenuous. It doesn't mean that you need to go hike a 14er or be skiing. It could be something more straightforward than that. Absolutely. But working on something that gets your heart rate up, it can be really brisk walking and doing that multiple times a week. And then finding things that, how I like to define the social aspect of it is finding things that you identify as meaningful. Mm-hmm. So it's not for me to say that you should do XYZ social activity. It's more about what aligns with your values, what do you find meaningful, and trying to incorporate some of that into your life.
Right.
It's good for your mood. It's good for your brain, we think. We know that anything good for your heart is good for your brain.
And don't make it difficult either. It could be something as simple as going to your bank and saying hello to Susie. The teller, you mm-hmm. know, getting up out of your house mm-hmm. and park in the last parking space and walk a little further. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? But we just can't give up. Don't give up and don't give in. Mm-hmm. It's important.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Not giving up, finding those things that you enjoy and not making it too complicated. Exactly like you said. There are ways to work this into your daily life.
Exactly. So how about this new study that you're working on? I'm hoping by the end of the year you're going to get it rolling.
Sure. Yeah, we also have a brand new study that was just funded by the Department of Defense. And that's going to be looking at another aspect of the immune system. So we're, again, looking at inflammation in the body and how it relates to memory. But we're looking specifically at people who have had a concussion in late life. So I think this is something that's on the minds of a lot of folks, is the relationship between head injuries, so hitting your head, and consequences down the road. There's a lot of controversy around this. I think very simply, we're not quite sure yet what it means. But in particular, I think what folks don't know is that there's a lot of information out there about when you sustain concussions earlier in life. You know, there's a lot of focus right now on football and all these different sports. But we also know that as we get older, that people sustain concussions later in life, too. So, you know, having, you know, slipping and having a fall or something like that where you've hit your head. And we're trying to better understand, what does it mean if you have a concussion later in life, and how does that affect inflammation in the body, and how does it affect your memory over time? So again, it'll be a study again with what we call healthy people, people who aren't having any symptoms but have had a more recent concussion later in life.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I'm just going to throw this out there. I heard you were working with the University of Wisconsin or something like that. Is that you? No?
I've done that before, yes. We had a great study come out last year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was that about?
In that study, we collaborated with University of California, San Francisco. We collaborated with University of Wisconsin. And we were looking at, again, inflammation in the blood and inflammation in the spinal fluid and how that relates to Alzheimer's disease pathology markers.
Okay. Is that what led you to some of the things that we've been talking about today?
Yes. Awesome. That was a really fantastic collaboration and a means of really getting, again, a window into, A, does the blood tell us something about what's going on in the brain? But also giving us a sense of, this was a younger group of individuals, so people in their 50s and early 60s, and looking at, are there changes in inflammation in the body and in the spinal fluid that tells us something about the brain?
That's
awesome.
It
seems like there is.
Yeah. And something you just said that you didn't say specifically, but it came out through what you just said, is that people often ask, do these research centers talk to each other?
Yes.
Are people working together?
That's a great question. Keep asking that question, because that's so very important.
It is.
We do not want to have siloed research.
No.
And what's most important to me is that we collaborate, that we share ideas, that we're not afraid of being able to relay what we're working on and having someone who's smarter than us figure it out too. I would much rather that happen than sequester any sort of data. So I hope people realize that we are very, very open to collaboration. We absolutely work with other researchers. We talk to them at meetings. I call fellow researchers at other institutions to ask, you know, their thoughts on a finding, see if we can extend it into their studies to replicate it.
Nice.
So it's an incredibly important piece of what we do.
Oh, it's crazy important. And I think it's wonderful. I know that University of San Francisco, you just mentioned, you were there prior to coming here.
Yes.
They were focusing, you were focusing heavily on the tau there, right? And we needed you to bring that piece to Colorado, which is awesome. I love that. You know, it's personal to me. But I love that. And even, I don't think people know, at your local hospitals, they have something called Grand Rounds. And Dr. Potter always lets me know when there's something there that might be of interest to me. And so you as a public can come. I would encourage you to read some books. I've read hundreds of books on neurology, and I'm non-medical, but I want to really understand what's going on and what we're talking about, especially when I'm talking to somebody like you. And it helps me, because then I understand when Dr. Holtzman comes from WashU and gives a speech and talks about how he thinks, you know, the tau is going around the brain and the beta amyloids on the inside, or whatever it was he talked about that day, was fascinating. And it's just amazing to hear information like that. And Cleveland's doing well. Risa Sperling and at Harvard's doing
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of things going on. There's a Dr. Bushkar that is trying to come up with something in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So everybody needs everybody, right?
Absolutely. We are only going to solve this if we all work together. And I certainly encourage people. We are trying to get out and give more community talks, you know, really transparently communicate about what we're doing. I think that's critically important. And so we're trying to do a better job, too, of advertising when we're giving a talk and where it's going to be, and certainly appreciate feedback from our community about things that you want to hear about. What are questions that don't seem to be answered right now that we could be helpful with?
Right. And this is going on all around the world.
Yes.
I mean, I was really surprised that the testing they do at WashU is a lot the same what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. That probably is true around the world. Our friends in Australia are rocking it. They're trying to find a cure as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got people all around the world in 323 labs in 22 countries. Mm-hmm. So find one near you and start asking some questions.
Absolutely.
Find out how you can participate in a study. Don't just sit on the sidelines and lick your wounds. Get in there and try to figure out how you can be a part of this. It's rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? If I were to be diagnosed tomorrow, I could honestly say that I did my part. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That I'm trying to be in the trenches, and I will continue to do that. Everybody, 4 people in my family have given their brain in our longitudinal study. That's amazing. My sister's going to give her brain. My brother's going to give his brain. He has FTD and frontal temporal degeneration. And I just feel like it's so important. That's why I'm excited to have you here today. I want people
Thank
to know
you.
How much it means to me.
And this, you know, Colorado community has been incredible as well. As you mentioned, I came from San Francisco. I worked at a fantastic center there, UCSF, and I've been overwhelmed by how welcoming the Colorado community has been and how excited people are about this kind of work.
Really?
So
are they coming out of the woodwork?
And yes, I feel like I've had more opportunities to communicate with people in the public here than I ever have before. And I certainly want
awesome.
To keep getting that feedback of what do you want to hear? What can we do to really support you and the community as well?
Oh, that's wonderful. And you all know, I was very happy to say that on August 24th, I had my 9th annual fundraiser for the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center. And this year we raised over $150,000. I just found out this morning. Don't have the exact numbers, but that's huge. When I had it in my backyard, I didn't come anywhere close to that.
We're so appreciative. It's amazing.
So this is another thing. My goal is not for me to write a check for $1 million because I can't do that,
mm-hmm.
right? But I look for people in my community that I can connect to the Rocky Mountain Alzheimer's Disease Center. You can do that too. If you know somebody that is a philanthropist and will give money to good causes, maybe has Alzheimer's or some type of neurological disease in their family, my goal is always to lead people to you that can make a difference.
Thank you.
And that's
Thank
how
you.
I make a difference. It's, you know, because I can't write that great big check, but
of
I can
course.
Find people who can.
Of course. Thank you so much. We appreciate any varying forms of support at our center.
You're welcome. And I'm excited about that. I want to tell you one more time about that, program that you are, the clinical trial that you are running. Call the Neurology Research Partners at 303-724-4644. Or you can email them at neurologyresearchpartners@ucdenver.edu. Okay? And just ask for the aging.
Mm-hmm. Healthy Aging Program or the Alzheimer's Disease Center. Absolutely.
That's awesome. Well, there's a lot of things that we can do, and there's a lot of things that we can not do. So you can choose to be a part of it, or you can choose to just hope for a cure and say a prayer. But you and I like to get in the trenches,
That's
and
great.
I'm so grateful for you.
Thank you.
I want to tell you really quick before we end for the day, just recently when I was at my research trial and at WashU, they took a biopsy from me,
mm-hmm.
and they said that the information from that biopsy, they can take that neuron and turn it into a brain neuron,
mm-hmm.
and take it back to 3 months before I was ever born.
That's incredible.
Holy smokes. So, people, I'm telling you, be excited. The reason I had Breanne Betcher on here today is because I wanted to talk about the studies that she's working on. She needs participants. Please call and be a part of it. And, you know, it's just exciting to see all the things that are going on. We don't have to have our head under a stone anymore. We
Absolutely.
Now know these different diseases are out there. Alzheimer's, different types of Alzheimer's, frontal temporal, Lewy body, all of those. They're there. Parkinson's disease, they're there. And we're on a mission to find a cure. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been great. All right. Well, I will see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. And stay strong, folks. Exercise. Go out and visit a friend. I love you. I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.